This week, just how much money are we throwing away when we don't raise the dues to reflect inflation? Can we run a pancake breakfast every day? We'll get a sneak peek at the all-new Occult Profile series on the Midnight Freemasons, and we'll wrap it up with a real example of how one Mason is applying his working tools just the way we prescribed them. Stay dialed in.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 432. This week, as we mentioned in the top of the show, we've got a few great pieces for you. And before we jump into that, I just would love to remind everybody out there of a few key dates. So, on the 21st of this month, February 2020, I'm going to be out at Landmark Lodge number 422, and I'll be presenting the Esoterics 101, but this time I will spend a little bit of time really explaining the origins of some of these extracurricular esoteric orders. I really shouldn't call them extracurricular because they're probably more fundamental than anything else, but we're going to have a great time talking about that. But in addition, there'll be Brother Bull Garlington, who will be in attendance, and he is fantastic. So please come out and say hello. Anybody who got the message that I put out about the 15 percenter pins, that's right, I have them. So if I see you at Lodge, ask me for a pin. And I will give you one. I'll have them in my pocket, hopefully, or in my bag. The very next day, on the 22nd, I'll be doing a brand new presentation called The Ark and Freemasonry, where I'm going to explore some of the legends of the Ark of the Covenant, some historical facts, its relationship to Freemasonry, and of course, its occult significance. It's going to be really fun. There is actually an Eventbrite for both of these events. I will post those in the show notes, and I would love it that if you want to go to these, please click on those and register. They're free, but they just want to get an accurate head count. So be a gent and do that for the lodge so that they can properly accommodate everybody. Then March 7th, the Southeastern Masonic Education Symposium. Tickets are available. Go to wcypodcast.com, click on presentation schedule, and you'll see 3-7-2020 Southeastern Masonic Education Symposium, and you'll click the little plus event details. And when you click that, you click the little buy your tickets now. I do need to make a quick apology. I was supposed to have Brother Angel Millar on the program to talk about his new book, but more than that, I wanted to ask him some questions about the piece that we read on the show just a few episodes back regarding the push to be really, really academic in approach in terms of Masonic education versus, say, a more esoteric approach and philosophical approach. There was a really great article that Brother Angel put together, and that is available if you go and you can click on the show notes of a previous episode and you can pull that up. But I had a tech failure. I am learning a few new tricks on how to record our interviews. And so I just want to apologize and say we're going to get that interview done and up just as soon as possible. I want to get right into the education this week. So I don't want to waste any time. So let's go ahead and pay the bills and then get right into the three papers this week. All right, so it's time to pay the bills. How do we make this show happen? This show happens because you, the listeners, help us out. So how do you help us out, though? Well, since July of 2011, this podcast has been here waiting for you every Sunday night at 9:30 p.m. Consistency is the name of the game. We are creating weekly Masonic education for anyone interested in Freemasonry and its kindred sciences. This is not a small endeavor. It requires hours of work each week on top of what we all have, right? We have work, kids, spouses, and we've got a few ways to help support this show. Really, our two main ways are through donations. You can become a contributor, a fellow, or a producer, and you can do that through Patreon. We have a $2 a month contributor level. You get your name on our website as a contributor, If you're a fellow, that's a $5 a month donation, and that puts your name on the website. I send you a card in the mail. I handwrite these cards when you do those donations. I don't have these things filled out. They're not pre-printed. None of that. This is me really trying to say thanks. Meaningful thanks. And of course, the producer level. Our producer level is $10 a month. You get the name on the website, a thank you card in the mail. And also with that, I'll send you the producer's pin also. Now, that's on Patreon. We have a lot of people who like to support us through PayPal. We offer those same exact perks. The contributor, the fellow, the producer, with all the same stuff through PayPal, a subscription model. So you can do either one of those things, or you can make a one-time gift through PayPal and just say, hey, I'm going to send you $2, or hey, I'm going to send you $3 one time, whatever the case is. I appreciate all of it. It offsets the cost of this podcast. Something to keep in mind is that we also sell the producer's pin by itself. It's $10. I have a Mason's Lady decal, and of course the It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry book that I co-wrote with John Rourke that has rave reviews all over Amazon.com, and you can get it on Amazon, not autographed, and you can get it on Audible also. All of the money that comes in through this stuff offsets the cost of putting this program together, and I want you to remember that you're the producer of the program, and in the last 10 years, Masonic education has come a long way. Is it a coincidence? Maybe. But we have to keep this ship on course. We're always pushing for better lodge experiences, Masonic education, and this show offers a way to assist people in coming up with new ideas and things to bring to lodge and to educate new brothers and people interested in the craft. So I would just say, if you're already a producer, a fellow, or a contributor, or you've donated cash at some point, or bought a pin, or whatever you've done for us, thank you, thank you, thank you. All right, many thanks to everybody out there who assists us, and also who checks out our bookstore and our friends, Franklin's Fortune. And please check out Intellectual Linear Progression. Open enrollment is happening again very soon. If you don't get in, get on the waiting list. It's a big deal. Use promo code WCY at checkout, and you'll get that 25% off of your first 3 months. So the first piece that I have this week actually is a piece that comes from the From Darkness to Light blog.com, and it's commentary on When the Meme Hits Home. So some of you might remember, I wrote a piece called When the Meme Hits Home, and I put it up on the Midnight Freemasons blog just a few weeks ago, maybe a week ago, I think it was. And it was my sort of breakdown of the situation that's happening in Freemasonry right now in terms of the esotericist and the regular member, right? So this was a response or a commentary, maybe a rebuttal of sorts, done from the From Darkness to Light blog. Again, author here is anonymous. Maybe I know who they are, maybe I don't, but nonetheless, I read this piece, this commentary, and I loved it. Not because, of course, right, they're making a statement about something I wrote, but I think what's emphatically different about this response, well, I'll let you judge, and when we're done reading it, we'll talk about it. But I think you're going to pick up on it real quick. Over a week ago, the superbly well put together blog site known as the Midnight Freemasons published an article by Right Worshipful Brother Robert Johnson, also of the Masonic Roundtable and Whence Came You fame, entitled When the Meme Hits Home. If you have not read this article, please do so here before you press forward with this post. All caught up? Great. On the face of it, a well thought out article. And the author does make some points that are worth serious consideration by those who really believe in the craft as a treasure trove of hermetic and transcendental philosophy. But underneath the obvious statements about Freemasonry being a ground floor to other more deeper and spiritual concepts in the world, I sensed a bit of defeatism in the letting Freemasonry be led as it is now idea that Brother Johnson is putting forth. Ultimately, I do not think that craft masonry, in its current form, is thriving or longing for survival as it exists today. The current organizational makeup of Freemasonry, at least in the United States, is not designed to flourish in its current form. The overhead of extremely large Grand Lodge systems that were designed for the quantity of members extant 50 to 75 years ago are too large and expensive to maintain as they are now. The expenses at the top trickle down to a mostly dwindling membership at the bottom. As costs continue to increase, there are fewer people to, quote-unquote, pay for everything. Is this the fault of the Grand Lodge system in general? Absolutely not. In fact, the primary root cause of the problem was the failure to maintain the burden of cost throughout the decades. Keeping dues artificially low has depleted the reserves of nearly all local lodges, and these lodges nowadays are all paying into a system to support it, but one that has a negative rate of return. $50 in dues a year in 1970s are not worth the same as today. So, for those lodges that have frozen dues and are still paying $50 a year, they should actually be paying $331.15 a year today to have kept up with inflation. That is a loss of $282 per member per year. No organization on the planet can maintain or even survive in such a financial state. Even in a single year, in a modest jurisdiction size of, say, 10,000 members, that is a difference of $2.8 million a year. With that influx of money, you could have catered pancake breakfasts every day. This is exacerbated when you look at membership statistics as a whole. With nearly all jurisdictions in the United States showing a loss in membership year after year, with only a minuscule few at an equilibrium or actual state of increase, coupled with the reducing value of our income, it is only going to become unsustainable far more quickly. The institution as a whole will not be able to send out trestle board, super relevant magazines, sarcasm here, or high-quality paper dues cards, sarcasm again, in such a poorly funded state. Why is this important? Because as a result of the above, we as an organization cut costs everywhere else to keep that quote-unquote bare minimum standard of living, and we as an organization suffer for it. We cheapen the experience, we cut out the superfluous things, and reduce the overall quality of the entire system by maintaining organizations with a one-tenth of the money needed in our modern era. You know, superfluous things like a truly worthwhile agape, education within the walls of the lodge, lodge halls of splendor instead of wood-paneled mediocrity, erudite discourse, and teaching newer masons and young men how to be a better form of themselves than they thought possible. At the end, though, Brother Johnson is correct in his assessment of the meme and its meaning. It is better to demit, leave, find a lodge more at your speed, or even start one of your own that meets your needs. As I have learned over the years, there are enough people around you that think about the craft the same way you do. Find them, seek them out, and give them a place to work. Once you are well established, take that change and move it upward. From darkness to light. I'm not sure if you guys caught it, but there was something in here that I thought was really interesting. Number one, let me first address the point at the top where it says that he sensed a bit of defeatism in letting Freemasonry be led as it is now. That is completely true. There is defeatism in my post, and it is an acceptance of defeatism, and rather not defeatism, but rather just being okay with the state of things. I would have considered it defeatism if I still viewed it as a war between the way I feel Masonry should be and the way it is. I'm now very fluid in my thought process about that. If you would love to understand more about why I feel that way, refer to the episode just 2 weeks ago when the episode was 430 and it was Dissonance in Freemasonry, and I read Greg Kaminsky's post. My views are very much echoed in Greg's views, so if you're curious why, that's why. The one thing about this article that I found truly staggering that was different than every other post that talks about any kind of dues and increases and things was the $2.8 million a year. With an influx of money, you could have catered pancake breakfasts, quote, every day. That's wild to me. A funny joke, but the $2.8 million a year is no joke. Could you imagine what you could do with $2.8 million a year? We make so much happen on less. I could only imagine what we could do. The splendor we could have. The image we could display. Not in multimedia or anything like that, but just the buildings, and it could just be amazing. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed that one. It's, again, from darkness2lightblog.com. Links will be in the show notes for this particular piece. I'll also turn this one into a PDF and you can download it. But on this blog, there's actually a few of the last posts were really great also. One was called, "So How Many Landmarks Are There?" And that one was really well also. So I was digging on these last few posts. So to the author, very much enjoyed, and thank you so much. Now, the next piece I wanted to do for you is actually a sneak peek. You'll get it here first. I'll put it on the Midnight Freemasons in just a few days. I started a new series on the Midnight Freemasons called Occult Profiles, in which I'll be running through some of the people that are responsible for the births of occult organizations or legends within the fraternity. People like Manly P. Hall, people like Paul Foster Case, people like Annie Besant, or Ann Davies, or Helena Blavatsky, A.E. Waite. All of these kind of people deserve to have a little something about them, and we have a lot of people out there today who are really diving into some of the esoteric books, and really it's a rediscovery of early 20th century spiritualism ideas, which was later, you know, birthed into the New Age a little bit. And so in an effort to try and level the playing field and get those people who are now being introduced to those texts, whether they're reading them or not, I'm seeing a lot of posts online with people, you know, they'll post pictures of books that they just bought or whatever, and I'm not sure they're reading those books. But if you would read them, I think there's, well, let's just say there's some intellectually dishonest statements when we read some of those things. And so what I attempted to do with the occult profiles would be to give you a brief overview of the people, their life, what they did, and why it matters. So Occult Profiles number 2, which will premiere just a few days on the Midnight Freemasons, I wanted to go ahead and give you guys a sneak peek of this one, and it's called Occult Profiles, Samuel Lydell McGregor Mathers. So sit back, relax, and listen to this amazing tale. Samuel Lydell McGregor Mathers was born in January of 1854. There is some confusion whether it was on the 8th or the 11th. He is most well known for having been one of the original founders of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. In his real life, he was a simple clerk with a simple education. His school was the All-Boys Bedford School, which was founded in 1552. In Samuel's day-to-day, he was a speaker of several languages. He had mastered, of course, English, but also was fluent in French, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and even Gaelic. There are reports of him even being able to speak in the late-stage Egyptian language known as Coptic. He also had two more interesting traits not usually attributed to anyone in those days. He was an avid non-smoker and a vegetarian. He was made a Freemason in Hengist Lodge, number 195, on the 4th of October, 1877, and was made a Master Mason on January 30th, 1878, all under the provision of the United Grand Lodge of England. Many of the influencers of occultism came from this mid to late 19th century, and it stretches into the 20th. We see the rise of spiritualism as a religion, not merely an interest. Later, this religion, which still exists today, branches out. I might suggest, but also with an air of caution, that this has evolved into the modern New Age view. Again, with caution. Samuel, living in this evolving spiritual and metaphysical world, naturally made use of his talents. Because he was a speaker of multiple languages, he was able to make translations of books not ever read before by English speakers. Books like the Abramelin, the Key of Solomon, the Grimoire of Armadale, and the Lesser Key of Solomon. He also was involved in writings that compiled the work of John Dee and Edward Kelley, the two famous occultists responsible for Enochian magic and the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. The latter work mentioned above is a wonderful amalgamation. The roots of the works are, however, dubious. In a small tangent, it is important to note that while the works of John Dee are as reputable as any in the field of the occult, those of Edward Kelley are not. This becomes a problem later when we trace the lineage of what was taught in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, the latter Alpha et Omega, and other bodies which branched off from here or hold a relation to, like the Ordo Templi Orientis, AA or AO, etc. I mean no disrespect in pointing this out, merely stating the obvious. I will be blunt and as factual as possible while writing these profiles. While involved in Masonry, Samuel joins the Societas Rosicruciana in Anglia, or SRIA, origin 1865. This Masonic body, quote-unquote, is a sanctioned version of Rosicrucianism, which does predicate membership on being a Master Mason. It was men only, and while involved with this, evidence shows that Samuel was also involved in receiving degrees in many other bodies, which one might consider any number of classifications, irregular, clandestine, or just plain spurious. Again, it was the late 19th century, and spiritualism was the hot ticket. Offering someone light or new philosophy was very enticing, and let us not forget, lucrative. While being heavily involved with the Rosicrucian Order, many members began to wonder about practical application of these esoteric concepts that were contained within the system. The system relied heavily on the once again dubious texts revered by the Order of the Golden and Rosy Cross, origin 1750. This order, and others similar in nature, have their legends and texts, those known as the Cipher Manuscripts and the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, 1459, among others. These texts also have questionable origins, which, of course, calls into question the validity of anything later which uses them. A firm foundation these texts are not. For a while, members of the Societas Rosicrucia in Anglia, SRIA, were satisfied with their memberships. But this question of practicality loomed. Meanwhile, Samuel received some prestigious awards in the SRIA, and in 1891, Samuel is called to give a lecture to the Theosophical Society, an organization whose founders, Blavatsky, Alcott, and Judge, we will cover individually in further installments of this series. A prominent member was William Wynne Westcott, a physician and a worshipful master of Kator Coronati Research Lodge from 1893 to 1894, who was the driving force behind the creation of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. The life of a clerk didn't always pay the bills. As a married man, Samuel had responsibilities. Some say hardships, and others say disinterest in the craft led Samuel to become delinquent in his payments to the organizations from which he had borrowed. This led to his expulsion. With this, he was now out of most of Freemasonry. In 1887, William Wynne Westcott, a few years before the Theosophical Society's lecture, along with Samuel, decided to found the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. They also had the help of William Robert Woodman. Woodman would become the leader of the Golden Dawn, but would die before the organization was expanded to create a secondary group within, the Second Order. The Golden Dawn was one of the first esoteric societies which allowed for co-ed meetings and in many ways venerated the status of women. The Golden Dawn relies on an interesting system of grades, which were very well put together by Brother Clint Louis in a piece that he wrote for the Midnight Freemasons. Upon Woodman's death, Samuel became the Golden Dawn's new leader. In Samuel's time in the Golden Dawn, he took on many students. One famed student was Aleister Crowley. Later, they would find themselves to be at odds. Part of the Golden Dawn is a connection with the so-called, quote-unquote, hidden chiefs, not unlike the idea of the unknown superiors, not to be confused with the titles of unknown superiors in OM or Martinism, but more along the lines of the hidden masters like Master R. St. Germain. Samuel, at a point, in 1900 was expelled from the Golden Dawn, there was some controversy over what we could call a scam by a couple of mediums and also a power move by Samuel to demand loyalty from everyone else. At this time, he and Aleister Crowley had attacked each other psychically, quote-unquote, and it led to a rift. Crowley was expelled at the same time as Mathers. Samuel had essentially said that he was equal to the Secret Masters. Samuel and his wife Mowena had moved to Paris and performed interpreted Egyptian rituals in theaters and the like to make some money. And while in Paris, Mathers starts an offshoot organization called Alpha et Omega, a Rosicrucian, Golden Dawn type organization with himself at the head. This organization eventually made it into the United States. In fact, another couple of people that we'll cover in this series, one of which, Paul Foster Case, was a member of Alpha et Omega. Paul Foster Case was subsequently expelled by Mowena Mathers, Samuel's wife, for informing the members that the ritual and the lectures were verbatim copies from two books available in the New York Public Library. Those works will be disclosed in another piece in the series. Samuel, as I have referred to him in this piece, was an interesting man. The name he is usually cited as is MacGregor Mathers, and yet this is a name he added for himself to emphasize his Scottish heritage, of which there is also little support for. Likely, he took this additional name to bolster claims that his contemporaries and followers believed that he was, quote, the reincarnated King James VI, the Wizard King of Scotland. In his early 20s, Samuel joined a volunteer military service, and although he never went further than the rank of private, he did have portraits made of himself in uniform to display, which added to his influence and ego. He died somewhere between November 5th and 20th in 1920. The mode of death? Questionable. There are some wild assertions here. One is that he blew himself up, of which there is zero evidence. One from his own wife, Mowena, who believed that Samuel died the result of a psychic vampire attack from Aleister Crowley. And finally, the most likely scenario, that he died of the Spanish flu. In conclusion, Samuel Lydell Mathers was an influential and esteemed occultist who was a regular member of our craft, an inspirational leader, although egotistical, and really, a genius. Whether or not the systems he promoted, the teachings he gave, or the rituals he performed were based on facts or hokey spiritualism, there is something of value in giving people a means to aspire to greatness, to altruism, a return to oneness with God. Samuel Mathers, like so many of his day, made a living as a sort of spiritual tramp who, through his conviviality and charming nature, was able to become somebody. A man who offered solace and hope to a Victorian world rife with death from consumption, sexual revolutions, and emerging ideas of equality for women. Samuel Mathers did in fact die, a somebody. Well, there you go. This is the profile that I've written that will go up. And hopefully there's enough information here that'll get you curious and maybe dig in a little bit deeper and think about some of the documents that organizations are founded on. And, you know, again, I'm not out here to slander anybody or to slander an organization or whatever. These are just the facts as they're written. We've got complete sources for all of these things that I'll talk about, and those will all be in the article. So I hope you enjoy. This one won't be in the app because it's not out in the public yet. So after Wednesday, you can catch it on the Midnight Freemasons. And speaking of the Midnight Freemasons, I would love to read for you this great new piece from Worshipful Brother Robert E. Jackson. Now, I first met Rob Jackson a few years ago. We had dinner together with a group of Freemasons, and we were talking philosophy. And Brother Robert E. Jackson has a unique perspective on Freemasonry, and I love how in touch he was with his psyche, with his inner self. He is an inspiration in that way. So he wrote this piece called The Perils of a Perfect Ashlar, and this was after a somewhat long break a little sabbatical, I guess, from writing anything Masonic. And I thought this piece was just fantastic. And so I wanted to read it for all of you because maybe this will help some of you just like it helped me. The Perils of the Perfect Ashlar by Midnight Freemason contributor, Worshipful Brother Robert E. Jackson. Several months ago, I started a journey. I was on a path to research the mysteries of Masonry and life in general, meditating daily, studying the blogs, and making sure that I read something every day. I was in search of the perfect Ashlar, and I was determined to get there. It wasn't for notoriety or fame or to be some master guru. It was just to be better. I needed to be better. My friends and brothers deserved a better me. My wife and kids, my family deserved a better me. The problem was, it wasn't me. I was convinced that every mistake I made, every wrong turn, was another part of the rough Ashlar that needed to be processed. The path became a series of checklists, and each task marked complete meant being closer to that perfect Ashlar. Each task not complete drove me deep into the recesses of that rough Ashlar, into both a figurative and literal depression. That mental state was viewed as yet another imperfection of the Ashlar, driving me further down into a horrible cycle. It was as if I was following a map, a path to enlightenment. Every wrong turn, every missed step needed to result in a punishment, or I would be doomed to make the mistake again. It all simply told me that I just wasn't working hard enough. This impacted every aspect of my life, as a brother, as a scoutmaster, husband, father, friend, etc. Every interaction was an apology, another area where I fell short of what my false self was telling me to be. I very quickly found out that one of the driving factors behind this obsession was a massive fear of rejection. Friends, colleagues, family will see me as less than what I am. God forbid they would see me for who I really am. And my kids deserve so much better. They deserve a better father, the best that anybody could be. However, that strive to be the best ends up as unrealistic expectations placed upon their souls. By demonstrating this urge for perfection, my fear of negativity impacting them was coming to fruition. The very thing I was afraid of was happening. So I turned to therapy. I took a break from all education that wasn't related to figuring out what was going on. Anything Masonic, work, or scouting related that wasn't urgent had to be put on hold. After years of telling people that our brains are our own worst enemies, I had no choice but to see this in myself. One of the first books I read, Whole Again by Jackson McKenzie, revealed quite a bit. This can be dangerous, however, because there is always the possibility of contracting quote-unquote medical student's disease. For those not familiar, this is the phenomenon often seen in medical students where they are immediately inflicted with every disease and issue they read about. There was one particular section, however, related to perfectionism, where it felt like I was reading a story about myself. The perfectionist struggles daily with expecting things to be the way they are supposed to be. There is some obsessive compulsive tendency here, like wanting dishes to be organized in a specific way. However, the majority of the feelings are around self-loathing and resentment. I can certainly see how the resentment can ruin relationships for those that are vocal about their needs and desires. Projects and tasks should be performed in a certain way. Any tasks I complete must be maintained exactly how I've done it. Again, reference dishes. When combined with the self-loathing, however, every time a task wasn't done as I felt it should be done, it became my personal problem. Either I would recognize that the inability to accept other implementations was another fracture in my rough Ashlar, or in some cases, I would blame myself for not communicating my intentions well enough. Certainly, there were successes and great accomplishments, but those all belonged to my team members or partners. I was not permitted to enjoy the success, as it wasn't mine. Another battle of the perfectionist is the takeaway on as many new projects as possible. This was completely obvious in my life, and I can't remember a time where I didn't take on whatever was thrown at me. Looking back in college, this actually resulted in a physical battle with mononucleosis that lasted over a month. I couldn't give up, though. I couldn't stop, no matter how much I was hurt, just like an addiction. Something inside my mind kept pushing me for the next project, the next contribution. For if I was able to do more, I would be more indispensable. I could become not just the perfect Ashler, but the cornerstone. That same cornerstone that was rejected so many times. At this point, I feel it necessary to explain that there is a significant difference between seeking sympathy, wanting the pity party, and self-loathing. The former seeks the attention, the assistance, while the latter hides behind the smiles and laughter. Self-loathing often results in seclusion and withdrawal from society, even though the camaraderie might be what we need most. Thinking about the law of attraction and the impact our feelings have on others, there is a fear, yep, another fear, that by introducing ourselves into a concert or meeting where we aren't in the quote-unquote right mind, may end up negatively impacting others. At one point, I almost skipped our Lodge of Instruction, a monthly district gathering we have in Massachusetts. My good friend, brother, and Midnight Freemason contributor Eric Marks was speaking. I was so looking forward to this lecture, but I didn't want to poison the room, so I was going to stay home. I forced myself to go, and I left that meeting a different person. Not just his presentation about meditation and contemplative thought, but simply being there with my brothers made such an impact. I was also able to speak with some of my brothers about my struggles, trying to understand the difference between self-compassion and self-centeredness. This distinction continues to be a struggle. We often talk about ego, the inner mind. For most of my life, I was convinced that our ego was merely the inner self that was the antithesis to charity. From the King James Bible, 1 Corinthians 13:5 states that, quote, "Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself. Is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil." End quote. Our ego is self-promotional, overbearing, pushing down others to make us feel better. I was so convinced that this was the only possible existence of ego, my way of battling the ego was to attempt to eliminate any aspect of selfishness. Ultimately, this led the path to egoism, and I was convinced that this was my way. This was how I was to serve mankind, and if I screwed up, it became a personal failure. Eventually, the depression of not letting go of the past transformed into an anxiety of making the wrong decisions in the future. At some points, the anxiety became debilitating, and once again, the fear became reality. Eventually, with help, I realized that this was exactly what my ego was doing. What makes me so special? I truly believe that there is a sense of divinity in us all, an unfettering compassion and love that is to be shared with others, and that's what makes us beautiful. I couldn't believe that I had it, because I'm fundamentally flawed. But what makes me so special to be imperfect and not worthy of this love, when so many others, even people I just met, are deserving of the love and compassion that I can offer? Ryan Flynn has some amazing presentations. One of my favorites is The Divine Master. Brother Flynn was talking about Michelangelo's early life, some of the people he kept company with and learned from, and of course, some of his greatest works of art. This is such a thought-provoking presentation and really enforces the idea of quote-unquote hidden in plain sight. I truly love some of the linkages between our lessons of today and those of the very distant past. At one point, Brother Flynn discussed the rough and perfect Ashlers and alchemy and transformation and simply making yourself better. Sometimes, that Ashler appears to be so rough, it's hard to imagine that it ever would become close to something beautiful. And yet, the amazing marble that was used to carve Michelangelo's David, possibly one of his most famous works, was discarded, judged by other artists to be useless. I'm certainly not comparing myself to the amazing artists of the Renaissance, but at that point in time, I realized that I dismissed my own Ashler. Brother Flynn mentioned a very inspiring quote from Michelangelo. Every block of stone has a statue inside it, and it is the task of the sculptor to discover it. I saw the angel in the marble and carved until I set him free. I couldn't believe that there was such a beauty inside of me. There I was, surrounded by my brothers and one of my favorite speakers, and I was drifting off because the ego was once again taking control. On my way home, I continued to think about this quote. There is a beauty within us all, including me. I started again down that dangerous path, though. If I get to this point, I'll be better. Once I perfect this lecture, I'll be a better Mason. Once I attain enlightenment, I'll be healthier. Once I read this book, I'll be smarter. Another book I was introduced to along the path was Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now. This book had a great impact with a very dear friend of mine, not a Mason, but after reading it, I learned that several Masons that I admire have incorporated many of the concepts of this book. Tolle speaks of a time as a fabrication of man. Within the animal kingdom, we are the only beings that we know of that ruminate over the past and the near future. The only point in time that matters to any of us is right now, this very moment, this very breath. Only we can let go of, when I can, I'll be happy. Only then can we truly be happy. I could understand the concept, but again, application of that tool eluded me. It was as if I was in the Lego movie, looking for the instructional books as I was not yet a master builder. If only I could attain enlightenment. That simple statement, that goal, was putting me back into mind, time, and removed me from the now. One of my favorite lines from the book so far is, quote, "The past is the past, and there isn't anything that can be done to change that. The future is the future, and whatever happens will happen." I still struggle every day. Even writing this paper caused me to reflect greatly on past behavior. Additionally, there remains a part of me that believes that by overcoming this obsessive quest for the perfect Ashler, I can be a better brother, scoutmaster, father, husband, friend. I am learning, though, that the kindness and love that you give to others will never last if you don't have kindness and love for yourself. Robert E. Jackson. Here's why I love this piece, guys. Because Robert is exactly applying the working tools to the temple. Everything we are taught about the working tools and their application on the temple, he is utilizing, he is measuring and squaring, making his temple perfect or working towards it. This is the reflective, contemplative nature of the craft. This is what our tools are for. And it takes a lot of courage to write something like this. But he knows that the audience for something like this were brothers, and we should be there to be supportive, to laugh with our brothers, to cry with our brothers, to be intimately invested in their well-being. And I think Rob has done a fantastic job. If this doesn't touch you on this level, if nothing else, this is a perfect example, in my book, of a Mason using the tools of Freemasonry. That's it for this week, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. I am very excited to continue to bring you the show week after week. We've got some great stuff lined up this year. I promise I will get the recording system set up so that we can start recording interviews again. I hope to see you all in Lodge. And before we go, just let me say thank you again to all of our producers, fellows, and contributors, whether you're on PayPal or you're on Patreon. I cannot thank you all enough for everything that you've done to help bring this program to everyone out there. Please remember to check out the Midnight Freemasons, posting 3 articles every single week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And, of course, the Masonic Roundtable. We were dark last week. We had some illnesses in the house. We will be back to talk about the Regis poem real soon. The Masonic Roundtable goes live every Thursday at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern. And with that, I hope you all have an amazing, amazing week. Stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.